Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Bahati Mutisia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazine. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Teen Vogue. The first article for today comes from Teen Vogue's OG History series, and it's titled, "The Art World Can't Exist in a Decolonized Future." This is by Angie Jamie, and it was published on June 30th, 2020. Since 1940, a formidable statue has stood sentinel at the doors of the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. Striking in its bold proclamation of President Theodore Roosevelt, the equestrian statue was supposed to be a monument to the statesman as a triumphant leader. More sinister, as the activist collective Decolonize This Place have protested against for the past several years, this statue is flanked by two other figures, one man of seeming African descent and one Native American descent at his feet, as Roosevelt, perched on horseback, towers above them. Despite a nearly 80-year legacy in a statement requesting that the equestrian statue be removed, the museum said, "Many of us find its depictions of the Native American and African figures and their placement in the monument racist." Amid nationwide protests against anti-black racism, white supremacy, and colonial violence, on Sunday, Mayor Bill de Blasio announced that after 8 decades, the statue would finally be removed. Reckoning with a violent past. From Mars Safour, an artist, organizer, and co-founder of Decolonize This Place, the removal of the statue is part of challenging the project of colonialism, the foundation of the government, and its related institutions. A piece of art, for example, in the case of the equestrian statue of Theodore Roosevelt, stands as a symbol of racial hierarchy, a monument to the conquest of land and people. Just as capitalism in this country has acquired its wealth on the backs of enslaved Africans, on stolen land of indigenous peoples, the art world is also very implicated in that history, Safour tells Teen Vogue. The removal of outright racist symbols is a crucial step in dismantling systems of white supremacy and challenging anti-blackness and anti-indigeneity, but it is far from the only step in challenging institutional art spaces as veritable crime scenes, as sites of cultural and historical theft. We really have to go back to colonial encounters. How the art world accrued its wealth, its value, and its objects over time, Safour says. The Brooklyn Museum, for example, has one of the largest collections of African art objects in the nation. On one hand, from a very capitalistic point of view, you could think, what a valuable museum. We should support the museum at all costs. But from a decolonial perspective, you're immediately asking not just who's curating those objects, but how did they get those objects? And we know the answer. It's through looting and imperialism. Globally, museums preserve more than 1 billion objects. A 2018 report conducted by academics Benedict Savoy of France and Felwin Sarr of Senegal found that 90 to 95% of Africa's cultural heritage is held outside Africa by major museums. France alone has at least 90,000 objects from sub-Saharan Africa in its national collections, of which 70,000 are inside the Kay Branly Museum. The questions that Decolonize This Place is asking, Safour explained, are rooted in the material effects of colonization that are seen in museum spaces. Really, until they're willing to repatriate and give up the loot, we're not going to see an erasure of anti-blackness in museum spaces, she says. The question of the hour. Beyond the physical items on view in the museums and gallery collections that form the institutional art world, the ways artworks are presented and the ways museums function, these spaces must also grapple with how it engages with people of color within and outside its walls. In 2019, journalist and curator Shidra Lebovier made history at the Guggenheim Museum, becoming the first Black curator and first Black author of a Guggenheim catalog in the museum's 80-year history. The fact that this milestone only occurred recently is staggering on its own, but it also highlights a legacy of racist exclusion and elitism within the institution that continues to this day. As the New York Times recently reported, the curators of the Guggenheim Museum wrote in a letter to the institution's leadership urging the museum and it addressed an inequitable work environment that enables racism, white supremacy, and other discriminatory practices. It's worth noting that the very letter from the curatorial staff at the Guggenheim would not exist without Lebovier's historic but double-edged achievement. Her work behind the scenes emboldened the staff members to draft the letter, Lebovier says. But it came out months after facing what Lebovier described in a recent Twitter thread as the most racist professional experience of my life. In the thread, she describes a relationship with the museum and its now sabbatical artistic director, Nancy Spector, as a battle for autonomy, proper credit, and acknowledgement from the Guggenheim, furthering erasure of this historic milestone. As for why the contemporary art world is so hesitant to address its ills publicly, even the Guggenheim's curator staff submitted its letter to leadership unsigned for fear of retaliation, Lebovier suggests that it is because of a culture of silence. Unfortunately, it comes down to whisper networks, she tells Teen Vogue. So much of the industry relies on social networking, parties, dinners, and unregulated wealth. No one wants to challenge that for fear of losing what is very elusive access to these spaces. Long gone are the days when a museum like the Guggenheim could get by with making a cursory statement in solidarity with those demanding justice and an end to racism. Urgent questions are being asked of the art world. Ultimately, can the museum exist in its current form in a future that is truly decolonized? That's the question of the hour, Lebovier contends. And I'm not saying that to be coy. I really believe that that's the question of the hour. We are going to have to rethink the entire structure of how art is consumed. If you take away imperial plunder, what else do you have to offer? Thinking of the future of art, Lebovier offers words to those interested in pushing boundaries further, saying, center yourself in your identity, know who you are, so you can shake the earth. The museum is in the streets. At once considering this country's colonial past and its current social push to undo oppressive systems of power, artist and decolonize this space organizer Natasha Dillon feels that the existing institutions must work in tandem with community stakeholders to create a new vision for public engagement with art, one with which looks beyond diversity and inclusion efforts alone. We need to completely change the form of how we even experience art, and I think that's what the decolonization and the abolitionist movement is working toward, which does not separate the art world from the real world, Dillon says. I believe it's Dillon. Let me correct that. Dillon. The art world is completely entrenched in what we see. In the context of a decolonial world, maybe they're not even called institutions. Maybe there's some kind of other body that is there for supporting and creating imagination, making us feel a different kind of world. That's really needed. For Dylon, those seeking change is a two-part effort. Focus on creating your own art world and not seeking validation from the one that exists right now, because it's going to disappear no matter what. Because it's going to disappoint us no matter what. That doesn't mean that we don't push for change, but we also make our own world, and that combination is what is going to allow us to live and breathe as artists. Launched to coincide with this year's Juneteenth commemoration, Sea in Black stands as a future thinking challenge to the institutional art world as it exists today. The collective of 80 Black photographers is both community-led and accountable to the communities which it documents in photography, with the mission of dismantling white supremacy through image making, and who raise funds in support of movements in civil rights, the arts, education, and criminal justice reform. For me, the museum is in the streets, the people, the cultures, the relationships. Everything I've seen growing up was beautiful, and that's artful to me, Joshua Kissy, photographer and co-founder of Sea in Black, says. To exist in a world that tells you you shouldn't exist is one of the most creative and artful things I've ever seen. Even within the lexicon of art, Kissy seeks to challenge the language around crafting images through photography. The lingo of capturing, shooting, and subjects, these words and language around the camera are impactful in terms of colonialism and imperialism. He shares that the person who had the camera, a tool of capturing scenes of exotic life, was often used as justification for pillaging or for colonizing of a place altogether. Historically, Kissy says, it implies that you have ownership over somebody's narrative, and it's never that. Adding, we're sharing stories. Instead of me claiming ownership over you as a subject and over your narrative. By being a Black photographer behind the lens, inherently the dynamic shifts beyond the white gaze, creating a communal experience. Another part of the Sea in Black project is building and investigating in an ethos of visual sovereignty in a visual language free of oppression. All profits from the sale of Sea in Black's images go to 5 nonprofits that work toward Black prosperity, like Colin Kaepernick's Know Your Rights Camp and New Orleans Youth Empowerment Project. We don't have our own wealth institutions when it comes to how we see ourselves, Kissy says. That's why Sea in Black is so important. In the past, people were begging for a seat at the table. Now, we should be thinking about how we build our own table. All right, the next article, still from Teen Vogue, is titled Milestones Lost to Coronavirus Leave Young Adults with Unclear Path Forward. The path to adulthood is more unclear than ever. This article is by Rainsford Stauffer, and it was published September 22nd, 2020. As schools reopen amid the COVID-19 pandemic, students are facing challenges they've never imagined. Teen Vogue's Fear and Learning in America series is exploring what back to school means for students this year and what they think about learning during the coronavirus crisis. Olivia Parker, age 22, spent the second semester of her senior year imagining graduation day, thinking over her plans to travel afterwards, and looking at apartments close to her future place of work. But instead of the big celebration she imagined, the culmination of my 4 years of hard work in my program was celebrated via PowerPoint in my significant other's bedroom, she tells Teen Vogue. The isolation and restructuring brought about by the COVID-19 pandemic, Parker says, left her feeling unsure of what normal milestones now look like. I think about what that day would be like, the hugs and the celebratory dinners with all my close friends, listening to my peers' speeches in the heat of May, she says of graduation. There's simply no college course or extracurricular that can prepare someone for what living through a global pandemic and economic recession truly is. Just as there doesn't feel like much of a guidebook for navigating work, mental health, and life during a pandemic, there aren't how-tos for growing up in one either. As the pandemic swept America, moments previously regarded as unmissable milestones fell away. Graduations took place over Zoom or were altogether canceled. Weddings were postponed, job offers and internships stalled, and young people experienced significant pandemic-related job loss. Becoming an adult is popularly conceptualized via life events. But young people coming of age during COVID-19 have been left with the unsettling business of navigating young adulthood minus markers that usually signify growing up. But just as COVID-19 has exacerbated disparities of healthcare and income, the loss of life events normally ascribed to young adulthood also makes it evident how much of the framing around them was never a reality for all young adults. Many of these milestones, including graduations, are actually age-graded normative influences. Darcy N. Powell, Ph.D., Associate Professor of Psychology at Roanoke College, tells Teen Vogue. That means they are events or experiences that tend to happen for people within a society at a specific age, like driving at 16, voting and graduating high school at 18, and college at 22. So when they don't, individuals often feel like they've missed out or that they are now off time from their peers, she adds, pointing out that the experiences afforded to individuals during the transition from adolescent to adulthood are very much dependent on factors like socioeconomic status. Young adults between ages 18 and 24 make up somewhere between 12% and 18% of caregivers. Some young people are their family's primary breadwinner, including teens who took on additional employment during COVID-19 to supplement their parents' loss of income. Not every young adult culminates in a graduation ceremony. Not every young adulthood culminates in a graduation ceremony, just like not every young person can afford time for self-exploration. COVID-19 pointed out that the timeline of growing up doesn't look the same for everyone. Julia, who asked to go by her first name to protect their family's privacy, aged 22, returned to college in January for the first time in 3 years. They dropped out for a variety of reasons, including to take care of their sick mother. Julia was excited about 2020. Julia was living by themselves for the first time and doing well in school, but classes shifting online left them questioning their career path. They have ADHD, which made online classes a struggle. Should I drop out again and try to go for a trade now, since when are schools ever going to open back up at this point? Julia tells Teen Vogue. They currently work at a pizzeria because they feel it carries less risk of exposure to COVID-19 than their other job options. Julia thinks it's harder for young people to be on the same traditional path their parents took, even just based on political issues they face. Tuition is astronomically high. We have a student debt crisis. We're suffering from climate change more than what our parents will have to suffer with. We are living in an economic recession during a pandemic, they say. My whole adult life has basically been going off the path that a lot of people expect you to go down. Of following the traditional path in young adulthood, Julia adds, I think that whole idea is about to be thrown out the window after this. But Powell points to research that demonstrates the idea of milestones indicating adulthood isn't totally accurate in the first place. In reality, she says internal factors like accepting responsibility and making independent decisions are the real markers of adulthood, not a ceremony at the end of school. Reaching adulthood, Powell explains, is actually a pretty tumultuous process, much more complicated than a series of milestones. It's not linear, and Powell believes young adults put a lot of pressure on themselves to suddenly flip a switch and become an adult. It could be one reason the grief of losing these external markers of growing up is so heavy. It's not just the loss of an event like graduation or moving into your first apartment in a new city. It seems more like the loss of what are perceived as rites of passages and uncertainty of knowing what's supposed to happen next. Teens dedicate time and energy to graduate from high school, to compete in a sport, and to perform or display their art, and they may now perceive there is no reward for their hard work. Some adolescents may lose motivation to continue working towards their previously established goals and begin questioning whether they should continue their current path, says Rhonda C. Boyd, Ph.D., Associate Professor of Clinical Psychology and faculty member at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, in a blog post, adding that the level of uncertainty right now raises a lot of stress and anxiety for young people. While milestones don't dictate adulthood, they provide a script to go by. And without that script, many young people feel adrift. Because we haven't lived through a pandemic, Boyd says, even adults can't provide much guidance about what is going to happen. I think mental health is being negatively impacted by the pandemic, and as it goes on, I think people are dealing with anxiety, stress, disappointment, anger, a range of feelings. There's loneliness, Boyd tells Teen Vogue. Alicia Nova, age 19, experienced significant loneliness and thinks that being a first-generation American and student has a lot to do with that mix of independence and loneliness. Some students have parents who know the system and can guide young people through what a normal experience would be. I haven't recently had a lot of moments that were really unexpected of just intense anxiety about growing up, she says, adding that the timeline is so in your face. Especially with COVID, I think it's become even more scary because we all know that people are losing their jobs, and it's like, oh my God, like I have to graduate in 3 years and everything is so uncertain. She points out that as a first-generation student, if she doesn't get a job, she can't provide for herself or her family. Now, Nova is focused on creating new milestones. Everybody is having a new, unique, unexpected experience, she says. As slightly older generations postpone life events that are still regarded as age-centric, like getting married, young adults are reimagining the stress and pressure that have previously come along with meeting markers of growing up. I personally believe people have tried to shame me for not going down the traditional path of you go to college for 4 years and then you graduate and then you go to graduate school and then you get married, have kids type stuff, Julia tells Teen Vogue, pointing out that while her peers graduated right before the pandemic hit and some have families, she was doing well. Dropped out, experienced housing insecurity, and has gone through different restaurant jobs. But now, they tell them, I get to create my own path in this age of being a woman. It's so great that I get to choose and have agency over how my life is going to go, and I'm going to run with that, she tells Teen Vogue. I don't really try to concern myself anymore with the idea of everything completed in an orderly time just because I've experienced that life doesn't work that way. I think they intended to keep her gender hidden, but then they ended up throwing in that she was indeed a woman. So, okay, the next article is titled How to Fall Asleep. This will fall under the wellness category. This is by Adrian Corcion, was published March 12, 2019. It might seem natural, but figuring out how to fall asleep can sound easier than it feels in practice, and young people especially can struggle with falling asleep, staying asleep, and getting enough sleep. The National Sleep Foundation recommends teens get between 8 and 10 hours of slumber per night. However, sleep deprivation among teens is on the rise. A 2015 study examined teens' sleeping patterns over the course of 2 decades and found that marginalized teens, particularly girls, those from working class and poor backgrounds, those living in urban areas, and people of color, experience less sleep. But it doesn't just mean you'll feel tired. Sleep deprivation can have a significant impact on not only your schoolwork, but also your physical, mental, and emotional health. Many have even advocated for school days to start later in the day so teenagers can sleep in. In the meantime, we have the power to create healthier habits to improve the quality of our sleep, as well as better regulate our body's biological clock. To help you develop better sleep hygiene, Teen Vogue talked to 2 experts about smart bedtime routines. The main tips include: get in touch with your sense of smell, reduce screen time, keep a strict schedule, and add some sound. Get in touch with your sense of smell. Experimenting with fresh scents can help you unwind. Essential oils may have the power to turn your bedroom into a relaxing, soothing space. Essential oils, particularly lavender, promote relaxation and sleep, Barbara Nosel, PhD, Chief Clinical Officer at Newport Academy, tells Teen Vogue. Put a few drops in a diffuser, rub a few drops on your hands, wrist, or temples, or place lavender sachets under your pillow. There are also aromatic mists like Wellco's Calming Mist that can be sprayed into the air. Essential oil diffusers, particularly those with timers, can be useful to fall asleep to. However, avoid candles and incense. A lit candle or incense stick can be a fire hazard if you fall asleep while it's still burning. And I'll jump to the last recommended tip. Add some sound. Certain sounds could help you when trying to fall asleep. Water sounds, in particular, have been shown to help sleeping. According to Live Science, this kind of white noise could help mask other noises that might interrupt your sleep. Having a masking form of noise can also help block other sounds you don't have control over, whether someone is flushing a toilet in another part of the house, or there are taxis or traffic outside. Whatever the acoustic insult is, Orfeu Buxton, an associate professor of biobehavioral health at Pennsylvania. Some products have these nature sounds installed. Otherwise, you can find apps, playlists, and videos online of ocean waves, birds chirping, and lively thunderstorms. All right, looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. My name is Bahati Mutisia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.